might be the case. So if that's the case, then no, I'm not asking you to go. I'm not asking you to go hunt it out. I'm asking you to, and you know, obviously, the most relevant for materials for that this particular issue will be the things that we talked about on the watercourses. But you know, and something else that I thought you might want to consider doing for this. If you look at the International Law Commission's draft articles on state responsibility, or you can look at some of the other similar documents that have been produced, but that's a good one. If you just search International Law Commission on the web, or I can post it if you don't have it, it has first the articles, and then it has a commentary on each article. That might be a format that you would want to consider. You can write it just as a straight memorandum if you like, but if that seems comfortable to you, you could say, well, you know, I really think we need to have language like this, and then explain why that seems like a good idea to you, and then you can give examples and you see if that works. One of the things I'm hunting for here is the list of people who are presenting today so that I make sure that I allow enough time for everyone. So we have, so it's the lineup and Michele. Yeah. Okay, great. So four people, so I'll leave about an hour. And so I wanted to talk a little bit also before I get into talking about the access to information question about something that I thought there seemed to be a lack of clarity in some of your treaty. Yeah, Jessica?
Okay. Sorry, that's okay.
Yeah, that's fine. Go ahead. Yeah. No, no. Yeah.
Some of the additional, like, secondary sources that you provided us with, the articles on changes that are happening are extremely scientific.
The latter, yeah, yeah. And I think one of the articles was the piece on groundwater, that these springs that have resulted, that the article is actually about tracing the water in the springs that led to the evacuation of a community to the glacial melt. So it's completely irrelevant, the scientific approach or the fact that they, you know, did this experiment on this particular molecule. We don't care about that. The point is that there's a phenomenon that's traceable according to some scientific information to climate change that engages transboundary water issues. And it can have a whole range of impacts. So that's what that's there for. It's not for you to worry particularly. If you can use the facts, use them, but I really want you to focus on the legal issues and the legal and broader policy issues, related policy issues. Is that other questions, thoughts? I think you can choose how you'd like to do it, but I would recommend that approach. I think that it focuses your mind on crafting the words. And in a sense, it's more from my perspective, what I'm interested in is seeing that you understand the material, that you know how to weigh the different elements of the international environmental law and use them together to make a point. I think from your point of view, I think that you'll learn more if you actually try to write down articles, draft articles. But I don't want to be too prescriptive about the approach. Please submit it on the BSpace site. If it does not seem to be going, then at that time, send me an email with the document. But I definitely prefer getting it on the BSpace site. So.
Mm-hmm.
It's the, yeah, it's May something, yeah. Yeah, it's the, and it's, I think I made it for noon on that day. So you may want to double check.
But it's pretty expansive. I mean,
what you can undertake. And
so is it okay if we, I guess ideally you could identify what the major flaws were and you focus on what those were, but if we have like an area that we want, we just decide that we want to, I mean, that would
Yeah.
Versions, it would be good to narrow our focus as opposed to touching every single thing we could, right?
Yeah, I could imagine. So I could imagine an answer that said, I'm just going to deal with one aspect of this. There may be three or four major policy issues. I'm going to just take one of these. You might acknowledge the other major points that you think. You know, say at the beginning, well, I think that there are 10 things that need to be addressed. These are the 10 things, but I'd like to really talk about this one because it's the most important, or I think it's the one that we can actually do something legally. I think the other ones end up being more political, or, you know, that would be the most effective approach. Other questions? What I may do, again, recognizing that you're not really going to confront some of the questions that you might have until you're really deeply engaged with it and that you may not have deeply engaged with it yet. I guess I need to put some limitation on it so that it doesn't compel everybody to wait till the last minute to do the work. But maybe if I get any more questions by the end of this week, I'll answer them by email if it's after tomorrow, and I'll send the response to everybody. But then after that, I think in fairness, for people who want to get it done early on, I need to cut questions off at that point. Okay. The point that I wanted to talk about before getting into the access to information issue is it's this question about being clear about the difference in treaty bodies. So there are some treaty bodies that are formed of the parties. Examples of that would be the UN Security Council and the UN General Assembly. This is sort of a nice opportunity to do a little bit of a harangue that probably has nothing to do with anyone in this class, but there's a tendency, certainly in the journalists in the world, to criticize the United Nations, but act as though the United Nations is not a creature of the members. Of course, what the United Nations chooses to do is dictated by the members. Similarly, the bodies, although the civil service may be poorly managed, that's a different matter. But there are bodies like the Conference of the Parties, Meeting of the Parties for the Kyoto Protocol, Conference of the Parties for a lot of treaties, including the Climate Change Convention and CITES. Some of the bodies, like the Dispute Settlement Body for the World Trade Organization, those are all composed of the members themselves. So they'll send, each country that's a party to the treaty will send a diplomatic representative, usually someone from their State Department, their Ministry of Foreign Affairs, sometimes from their Ministry of Environmental Affairs, sometimes a financial minister, sometimes it's a lawyer who works for one of these agencies. Depends on how high level the meeting is, what the nature of it is. But those people have they'll send someone with the authority to make a vote on behalf of the party. So that kind of body, a body that's constituted of the membership to the treaty, has a lot of authority. If according to the rules set out in the convention, that group takes a decision, that's a decision, okay? And that, so even if there's something in the treaty that says that this group should review information or it should, you know, consult with somebody, remember, that is the body that has decision-making authority. Then there can be a kind of a tension between different bodies. The secretariat, most treaties have a secretariat or some entity that acts as a secretariat, and those people are by and large what are called international civil servants. So they don't work on behalf of their government. When I worked at the UN, I was an international civil servant. I did not represent the interests of the United States. I represented the interests of the United Nations. Just as when I worked for the federal government, I represented the interests of the Department of the Interior and the United States government. So those bodies that are composed of international civil servants are quite distinct. They are under, as employees, they're under, usually when they're on the grounds of the international organization, this varies, but usually they're under the jurisdiction of the international organization. Depends on the host country agreement between the organization and Switzerland or Germany or France or the U.S. or whatever, Thailand. And whatever kind of rules they're subject to, usually if they're outside the organization, then they're subject to the normal jurisdiction of the country that's the host country. Those people only have the delegated authority that either the treaty or the body, the conference of the parties or whatever other body makes up the parties, bestows upon them. This is where some of the tension came with the Endangered Species Convention, with CITES, that the secretariat has a lot of authority for compliance. And that's one of the things you've probably seen as we've looked at different treaties, that there'll be a different balance about who's really responsible for compliance. Is it through agreement? Is it, how is that handled?
Mm-hmm. So, in a sense, in one sense, it seems like technically, though, they actually are kind of the same in that the treaty bestows some type of delegated power to these different bodies, whether it's the secretariat, the CITES, or whether it's the Security Council. But that, clearly, in the latter case, that initial power is far greater because it's composed of member states, and the member states are feeling they can trust the more delegated type of power in the long term because they have a say in it. So, like,
Yeah, so the Security Council, and in fact the UN is kind of interesting. We'll be hearing about a treaty later today that also has two-tiered membership, and that's what the United Nations has, because the authority bestowed on the Security Council is through the UN Charter, so it's structured that way. It's not that the General Assembly, which is the body of the whole, delegated authority to the Security Council. So that's a little, it's a little bit special. And the way the Security Council works, as you know, of course, is there are the permanent members, and then there are the rotating members. So the rotating, and then the permanent members have a veto, which the rotating members do not. So it's a very complicated structure, trying to reflect the political reality of power as well as the desire to be a representative organization in some way. I think it's fair to say you would never give a secretariat the final decision-making authority on important issues that would affect states. Obviously, the Security Council's got mega superpower, but... Does that And does that get at what you're saying, or
well,
is it?
In theory, yeah. It's not like there's something that says that the Secretary of Body is creating something like differently, like a body which we think of as more outside, right? I mean, it's all kind of technical things. I mean, the same thing. The treaty provides power of the core and the states that ratify it, create whatever they create. Mm-hmm. Sometimes there's sort of an inner circle group where the states like best power within their ability, and then they can be more proactive mm-hmm. in the treaty, sort of. I mean, like, right? Like yeah. That's why you would have that.
Yeah.
In between the two of you, like you're saying, CITES, where you actually have a secretary that, or someone who isn't sort of a state delegate that has enough power with like that kind of clash with what states may or may not want to do.
I wouldn't, but I still feel like you're overstating it a little bit because the, for instance, with CITES, although there's a lot of ability for the secretariat to make recommendations, ultimately the recommendations have to be adopted by the conference of the parties. So there won't be that final decision making. Yeah, Morgan?
I want to make sure I'm understanding you right, which, mm-hmm. with the distinction. Is it yeah. in a sense that in the first sense you have sort of bodies that have inherent rights because they're comprised of the parties and like the conference of the parties versus the secretariat mm-hmm.
So it, theoretically, in principle, could you give a secretariat full authority to make final binding decisions?
That's kind of right. There is nothing inherent about this. Like when we talk about these councils having more power, it's because the treaty gave them more power. But
yeah.
It's like an arbitrary distinction that we understand is like states aren't going to delegate mm-hmm. power away unless they continue to retain some control, which something like the Security Council allows, where like the most powerful states can veto.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's right. There is a lot of discussion now in the climate change context as people are playing with different ideas about how you can structure a new agreement. It's how much authority can you give to an entity like the executive board or another kind of entity? Can you sort of create a scientific body that would say these are the targets for each country to achieve, and here's your allocation. I mean, people talk that way, as though you could, but...
Is there something comparable to the Security Council in, like, a very strictly international environmental treaty, like, where they have a collective body that other states have gone to see? Is that how it
is? Well, the Antarctic Treaty is probably the closest example to that, so that's... talk about it. It's actually more, but it's got this inner core of nations that have more authority than others. It's not an approach that's used a lot, but it's an alternative. So it would be there are problems that arise when you give a lot of authority to entities that are not states. I'll give you one more example, actually, of a situation that we'll talk about tomorrow with the United Nations Compensation Commission. So this was a war reparations body that was established by the Security Council, and it's set up with panels of commissioners who act in their own right and as experts, as legal experts, and a secretariat that will... international civil servants. But in the end, although an enormous amount of work was done by those two parts of the institution, all of the decisions and recommendations were ultimately referred to what was called the Governing Council, which is composed of representatives of the... it's actually the way it's composed. It's members of the Security Council at any given time. So it's a rotating body. But... So again, you have that need to get the imprimatur of the states directly on the final decisions, on the final functional decisions. Yeah. Yeah, some of the... So Iran-U.S. Claims Tribunal was different because there were, although, yeah. No, it was different. You'd have to say it's different because the judges were like real judges. Yeah. So there's a judge from, let's not get too much into the details on that one, but that's, and the criminal courts are probably different too, which you're going to sit around, but you probably are have a heightened awareness of that issue. Yeah, so the international criminal courts are a different situation. But talking about the normal treaty structure, that's a nice point. The third group that you'd have, so you have the bodies that are made up of the parties to the convention, you have the international civil servants, who are usually the secretariat. You then have experts who are individuals who are appointed in their own capacity, in their individual capacity, and that can pose a real problem. Usually they're scientists in an environmental convention, and they're advising, so they're, you know, scientists who are reporting their research. That's not a highly risky business. But a more difficult issue has arisen with the clean development mechanism under the Kyoto Protocol, and you may have read some about this, that the clean development mechanism at the sort of top decision-making level of approving or rejecting projects is the executive board. And the executive board members, the question has been, if they're individuals acting in their own capacity, can they be sued? Do they have personal liability for decisions they take that might have an economic consequence? There are even sort of crazy questions about, you know, who pays their airfare and how much, because they may not have the same entitlements. We ran into issues with commissioners from countries that couldn't travel to Iran, for instance. And how do they travel? Because they can't get United Nations passports because they're not United Nations employees. I don't know what their status is, but... Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the UNCC commissioners were paid by the UN, but they got a fee and they got a per diem. But they weren't full employees, so they're not. Yeah, so you have to really be conscious of this as you're looking at the treaties and thinking about what the authorities are given to each of these bodies and what capacity they have to act. And if it's a two-tiered agreement, then you have to be watching, or, you know, theoretically you could have multiple tiers of control. You really have to keep your eye on that. So that was one of the issues that I wanted to mention. There's another issue that is bound to come up, and I was talking with someone else about this outside of class, but it's the soft law, hard law issue. So I thought today, maybe as we talk about some of these access to information issues, you could tell me what you think is soft law and what's hard law here. And see if we're in agreement about that. So, should I go ahead and start on that part? And any other thoughts about different players in conventions? No. So, for today, you read a little bit about a particular incident, and then you read mainly the Peter Sand piece and the Aarhus Convention. Access to information is a really fundamental issue for international environmental law. And, you know, if you have a fire at a chemical plant or you have an incident, this is a picture of the Chernobyl reactor. Experiment goes wrong, reactor core begins to melt down. You have to decide what to do. It's impossible to do anything if you don't have information about it. If you don't know the incident occurred and the pollution is invisible, if you don't have time to prepare, to react, And you can't have a plan if you don't know about a potential hazard in order to respond to it. Another way information comes up is if a project is proposed, it hasn't, nothing's happened yet, but it may pose a threat. So this is a picture of the Sellafield MOX plant in the United Kingdom. And it was the subject of a longstanding dispute between Ireland and the UK. The plant itself reprocesses spent nuclear fuel. So it meant that the fuel had to be shipped in, it had to be shipped out, which raised concerns about terrorism and accidents. The plant actually had been doing some of this processing and had a bad record on leaking into the Irish Sea. And so concerns about an expansion of the plant centered around environmental impact statements and whether there had been sufficient information provided to Ireland and whether Ireland was able to actually weigh in on the decision to implement the development of the plant. And in these cases, you know, there's often very concentrated interests that are going to benefit, and it's very diffuse public interests that will be harmed by it. So there's a lot of incentive for project proponents or for government or industry actors to keep the information confidential, to not be very forthcoming with it. There's a lot of, and there are real costs to it. There is the cost of time. It takes a long time to share information. There's a financial cost of distributing documents and, you know, having staff to deal with it. There's real differences in what the public might think of a risk and what professionals think of a risk. Now, of course, it's ironic to show pictures of Chernobyl because one of the classic examples of different public and professional risk assessment is with nuclear. And normally, nuclear engineers say it's an extremely low-risk industry, and the public has a horror of the Chernobyl-type accident, so rates the risk much higher, even though, even taking Chernobyl and other known nuclear accidents into account, more people are killed on the highway than are killed by nuclear power plants. So I wanted to at least briefly mention there's different aspects of thinking about this. Obviously, the notice issue is one that we've spoken about. It is an issue. Notice from one government to another is considered now an element of sovereignty. It's also, notice is something that allows emergency response, so it has a very strong policy element to it. And it's a component of public access to information. It allows public participation, public engagement, and decision making, which is part of the democratic approach to open government. So, in international litigation, there, I'll get to the role of notice and information in international litigation. Adaptive management is an approach to environmental management that's practiced at the domestic level. It essentially implies that you will have, rather than a static rule that's unchanging, you'll have information coming into the process, into an institution on an ongoing basis, updating the condition of the environment and allowing the rules to adapt at the same time. Another aspect is the accountability, regulation by information, which was what the Peter Sand article was significantly about. And he talks a lot about the dynamics that make simply revealing the fact that a particular plant is using certain chemicals by itself as a kind of regulatory effect. And monitoring for compliance and enforcement, of course, information is one way of telling if a government is complying with its commitments on, for instance, in a climate change agreement or CITES or any of these other agreements. So the Chernobyl accident was an example of what happens when things go wrong. In 1986, technicians at the Chernobyl plant tried a poorly designed experiment. It went wrong. The reactor's lid was completely blown off, you can see. And large amounts of radioactive material were released to the environment and spread throughout Europe. There was no notice, and they actually thought that they would be able to cover it up. But it very quickly, Swedish monitoring stations reported increased levels of radioactive materials in the atmosphere. And the Soviet government admitted the truth. 13 people were killed, probably hundreds of thousands of people, millions of people were exposed to radiation at some level or other. And I haven't seen an estimate of actual number of cancer deaths. It would be very hard to do resulting from this. The Seveso incident that you read about was kind of similarly in 1976 near Milan. An explosion released a toxic cloud that contained dioxin, which is extraordinarily toxic material, from this chemical plant. Not only did people not know that this stuff was being handled there, so there were no safety plans, no preparations, but they weren't told when it happened, and there was a denial that went on for a while. Ultimately, a few days after it happened, measures were taken, but you know, children had to be evacuated from the area. Livestock was killed. There were huge economic problems, and compensation was ultimately paid. The result of this was for the Europeans to actually pass legislation that addressed the problem. And addressed the need for information for risk assessment, for safety planning, and for emergency response. There's a difference, though, and I think that the readings that you had underscored this, but it's important to pay attention to it, I think. There's the right to know and the need to know. And the European legislation still gave a lot of discretion to the governments. And there are arguments of why this is better. So if you take the nuclear example, you could say, look, think about in the climate change context. Nuclear power, if the U.S. had gone ahead and developed it, if we hadn't had such an open process that the public could actually put the brakes on development of nuclear power, we might have been in the position of France and had 80% of our energy coming from something that didn't emit greenhouse gases. And we wouldn't be in danger of all, and have put the rest of the planet in danger of the problems that come from greenhouse gas emissions. The European view for a long time was that that kind of decision is best made by experts who can truly weigh and balance the costs and the benefits in a more dispassionate and better informed way than the public can. So it's this very distinct difference between direct democracy, where the uninformed public gets to make a decision and maybe makes the decision without even having read anything about it, without having educated themselves. Or you have a highly technocratic, sophisticated, and well-informed group of people making those decisions. And again, in Europe, a lot of the things I've read have been more about England and France in particular. There was also this kind of close relationship between industry and the government, which could be very effective. I mean, it's not necessarily all a negative conspiracy thing, which is what Americans tend to think of it. But you can have self-interest play too strong a role and end up with disasters. So that balance between the right to know and the need to know is one of the distinctions that you can find in different national approaches. So if you think about this, a lot of the agreements, a lot of the issues that we've discussed have been state-to-state issues about information, about notice and access to information. But there's also this public right, the individual right, and that's, I think, something that the Seveso accident and the Chernobyl accidents really underscore. It's not just the government protecting its citizens, but the citizens having the right to take action themselves. One argument is that you can actually find an individual right in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. So this Article 19 says, everyone has the right to freedom of opinion and expression. This right includes freedom to hold opinions without interference and to seek, receive, and impart information and ideas through any media and regardless of frontiers. Now, that's normally read, or might be read, as a kind of, the U.S., we talk about a First Amendment right, right to speech. Again, is that the same as the right to get information from the government? Is the right for us to talk about the environment amongst ourselves the same as our right to send a FOIA request, a Freedom of Information Act request, to the U.S. government and say, you know, tell us what materials are being used by the government and, you know, undertaking some activity? This is FOIA. It's the Freedom of Information Act. I'm writing it because I'm going to probably keep saying FOIA, so that you won't be confused. So this is the distinction that is made when people are talking about the Aarhus Convention is the active obligation of the government to give you information about things that you need to know, and the passive obligation of the government to give you information when you ask for it, when you demand it. They're different scope. The 96 Draft Declaration on Human Rights and the Environment, which you saw, I think, as part of the reading for the Human Rights and Environment class, talks more explicitly about the whole scope of information rights for environmental purposes. But there's a whole range, starting with Principle 2 in the Stockholm Declaration. Although I thought it was interesting, you also saw in the reading that in Sweden, in 1776, there was a law passed that gave public access to government information. There's this broader context for this that starts in the U.S. in the 50s, I guess. Some in the 19th century, and then really the Sunshine Laws really start developing in the 50s. And you start having laws that require government meetings. If we were a city council meeting, for instance, right now, you know, we were all going to be voting on public affairs, the public would have a right to sit in the decision meeting and observe what our decisions are. Would have rights to look at documents, to look at certain kinds of public documents. There are some of these are quite long-standing rights. So in the Stockholm Declaration in the environmental context, this gets transformed into a statement about the flow of scientific information and transfer of experience. The World Charter for Nature talks about ecological education, it talks about scientific research, and the dissemination of that knowledge unimpeded by restrictions of any kind. If you think about the companies that do genetically modified organisms, you know, they do that kind of synthetic biology, well, they certainly are not consistent with that because a lot of what they do is proprietary and isn't shared. And the question about whether GMO products and seeds should be so labeled and always so identified is hotly debated. That's an issue in the trade context. The Rio Declaration similarly has information principles. Agenda 21 has a whole chapter that addresses information. Mm-hmm. It's well, normally international agreements don't act directly on private parties. They act through governments. So normally it's up to citizens to demand that their governments implement oversight regulations. It's a good question. So if we look at these agreements, how would you characterize them legally? Are these hard law, soft law? Soft law. Yes, softly said. Those are all soft law. But then you start seeing these principles in conventions, like the Basel Convention, which is essentially about prior informed consent. So you have to have information. You have to reveal to it. Now, it's still here, it's state to state, right? But it's saying you can't just ship something. You can't let. And actually, maybe here's a partial answer to your question, Carolina, because this is the Basel Convention is a state-to-state obligation. But what it says is that a state can't allow its companies to ship a product and not declare it to the other government. So it, in some ways, there's a little bit more transparency there.
Mm-hmm. So just to be clear, the World Charter for Nature and the Rio Declaration Stockholm Convention inclusions of this are soft law because they're sort of ideas and principles in addition to the central focus of the individual treaties? Or
these aren't treaties. These are all declarations. Okay. None of these are treaties. The Aarhus Convention is a treaty. Yeah, that is hard law.
So those carry
more weight. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You see where I'm going. So you do. You start seeing these different kinds of obligations. Now, I think if you wanted to make that argument as a general matter, what you'd need to really do is home in and focus on the idea that these are very different kinds of commitments. It's different kinds of information. It's different entities that have the obligation to divulge the information for different purposes at different times. So if you wanted to actually see whether there is some kind of a general principle of international law, some customary international law that can be broadly brought to bear against a state, you'd have to do a lot more analysis to get to the bottom of whether each of these is really kind of a lex specialis for a particular case or whether it's something that gets at a deeper principle. And you should remember that there's very strong arguments against disclosure in many cases. And I'll get to in a moment to what the disclosures, the limitations on disclosure under the U.S. Freedom of Information Act are, just as an indication of the kinds of concerns. But there is, I think, this other argument that at least some of these principles are truly part of international law in a broader sense. The Corfu Channel case is a duty to warn. So a duty to warn is information. That's providing information. The Lac La Nue arbitration, again, it's an obligation out of respect for the fundamental sovereignty of another nation to notify that nation of some activity that's going to have an impact. And these are, in a way, kind of, you might argue that the Corfu Channel case is a little bit more like the disaster cases, the disaster context, and that the Lac La Nue arbitration is a little bit more like an environmental assessment approach. This is a long-planned activity. The other is more of a hazard. So, the MOX plant case, again, this is the Sellafield nuclear materials processing plant in the UK that was the subject of a Law of the Sea dispute. It was brought to a couple of different fora, three different fora, one of which was the International Tribunal for the Law of the Sea, and then it was deferred to an arbitration tribunal established under the Law of the Sea Convention. And there, the argument that Ireland made was that the UK had not given a suitable environmental assessment and had not allowed Ireland adequate participation in the decision-making process. So, carrying out that other element. What I'd like to do is talk, I just want to touch on the exclusions from FOIA, and then I want to have some Q&A and then move to the presentations. So in the US, the access to information, one of the most important tools for that is the Freedom of Information Act. And you can request all kinds of information. You can ask to see your own FBI file. You can ask what was the basis for a decision about a land claim that you had in Alaska. You can ask what were the notes taken at a meeting between the head of the Fish and Wildlife Service and the Secretary of the Interior when a decision about listing an endangered species was made. You can ask for all of the data about particular microbes found in the thermal geysers at Yellowstone. You won't get those, actually, because I think the reason you don't get those is because in part of B4. And it may also be that it's an unreasonable request because there's too much data. But these are some of the categorical exclusions. And I can tell you, having done this, one of the things that staff lawyers have to do in federal government is when these requests come in from the public, everybody's got to do some of these because there's so many. All the junior lawyers have to do some of these because there's so many. So you get the request, you go through, you hope that you can find a categorical exclusion to say, oh, no, 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 national security. Because otherwise you have to get people in the agencies to go out and actually get the stuff, and then they come back and they complain or they didn't find it. But in general, it works amazingly well. So national security is one of the big reasons why some information might not be divulged. Personnel matters, personal privacy issues are another. Some things are specifically exempted from disclosure by statute, and that sounds like that could cover pretty much anything you wanted. It's somewhat more restrictive than that, but we don't want to go into the details right now. One of the sensitive areas is trade secrets and commercial or financial information. And that, like the national security exclusion in 1A, is a very particular, it's very circumscribed. So for national security, the information actually has to be classified to be excluded. It's not just an arbitrary decision, no, it's national security stuff. You actually have to go through another process to do that. Similarly, I've abbreviated some of this, but the trade secret and commercial or financial information exclusion is more limited. Law enforcement purposes. I highlighted the regulation or supervision of financial institutions because it just seems like maybe that shouldn't have been there. Maybe that information should not have been excluded from FOIA requests.
When you read through the exceptions, like the written information was watered down because of all these exceptions. Basically, people are interested in things which are controversial, and these exceptions could be used to deny, to refuse.
These are apparently pretty narrow. They, in my experience, I actually had some sensitive matters to deal with where I had to consult with my bosses, and we let information that was quite sensitive go. We sent it to the people requesting it. Things that you would have been kind of surprised about. They're read, and obviously it depends a lot on the administration. It depends on the individuals involved about how they interpret it. But I think that the practice in the U.S., and also I think you saw in the Peter Sand article, he certainly characterized the U.S. practice as being very balanced towards divulging information. One of the big criticisms of the last administration, the Bush administration, was that they were much more inclined not to disclose. And some of the big legal battles, in fact, over the Bush energy plan, one of the big legal battles had to do with their refusal to disclose information. So, yeah, it's something that gets tested in the courts.
Has there been any situation where the denial of information was referred to the court?
Yeah. Yes. Often. Lots. Yeah. This is one of the big areas where environmental organizations, NGOs, litigate. When they are trying to get at a substantive issue, often they start with FOIA to get at the information that they need for the other litigation, and that itself can become a big subject of litigation. So let's take a couple of minutes. There's a lot more you can say about this, and I've got like 20 more slides. But what I'd really like to be sure as we have time to hear about the treaties that y'all have been working on. So are there any sort of burning questions about the information stuff? And we could always pick up tomorrow, too, if you think of something. Yeah. Then,
yeah? Just a general enforcement question. So FOIA is a domestic statute.
Yes.
So in terms of the HUD law incorporating the Basel Convention, for example, mm-hmm.
That's a good question. With the Basel Convention, you have sort of a built-in issue there because you have trade partners. So if the U.S. tries to ship toxic materials to Ghana and doesn't provide the appropriate information and Ghana finds out, then Ghana can simply say, well, sorry, we're not accepting any more from you. Whether there have been disputes under Basel or enforcement cases, does anyone know? Has anyone seen that? That is, as long as they find out. Yeah. You could imagine that there are things that might be prohibited but would be harder to detect where you would rely on the sending country to be very responsible about it. And there's always failures in responsibility to just. So do you want to do the, do you wanna start?
Yeah.
Okay. Do you have a PowerPoint or?
I do.
Okay, great. Okay. You should be able, I saw that you guys were able to post in the end, so yeah, you should be able to post. Yep. And it would be great if more people would post, because it's nice to have them up there. And I, oh yeah, well, I'll swap them. And also, you'll have access to the space, I assume, for quite a while.
Has anyone used the B-Space for a long time after the class?
I think I used it this semester for the last semester.
Yeah. So you need to...
Okay, hold on. Let's just make sure. Yes. Okay. So my treaty topic was the Inter-American Convention for the Protection and Conservation of Sea Turtles. Long name, but I, in my opinion, it's actually one of the more successful treaties we've covered so far for a couple reasons. But we'll start from the top. So there are probably, I think, seven sea turtle species total in the world, and of them, six of them have their nesting and migration territories primarily in the American continents. All of the sea turtle species are either on endangered or critically endangered, currently on the CITES Appendix 1, on the IUCN Red List. So this treaty tries to deal with conservation issues, protection and conservation issues, more than the other treaties we've seen that deal primarily with trade issues like CITES. The IAC does, however, try and work really closely with these treaties to sort of accommodate trade measures. The treaty itself contains provisions that say, for example, that they'll comply with the GATT, all the GATT articles regarding technical barriers on trade, and so they sort of limit the sanctions that countries can impose and the ways that countries can implement domestic legislation to achieve the goals of the treaty. Sea turtles face, you know, the same dangers we saw in the shrimp turtle case, for example. Accidental capture, which is called bycatch, from fishery shrimp operations. Lots of intentional capture and trade for parts and meat. Extreme environmental sort of events, hurricanes, that things like that result in destruction of their nesting and migratory habitats. Chronic pollution. There's a really, you see sad incidents where turtles mistake plastic bags for jellyfish, and you know, a lot of them die that way. And a big problem actually is the deterioration of nesting habitats through human sort of expansion and beach littering, things like that. So countries try to address all these different areas as part of their own enforcement mechanisms. So the convention entered into force May 2001 with the 8th ratification, which is actually the United States. But there weren't any provisions requiring larger states to ratify before the treaty came into force. 12 nations currently. One more is coming up soon. Actually, the next Conference of the Parties has been rescheduled for April 23rd and 24th, so it's coming up, and that'll be the fourth one. The real emphasis of the treaty is more on information sharing and technology sharing among the parties. The Secretariat's function is the most emphasized. I'll get to that in a second. One other thing we've talked about is the special fund. We've seen it in a couple other treaties. In this treaty, again, it was established to cover expenses related to secretariat functions, like distributing the annual reports and research results. And it's actually decent. I mean, the annual reports show that it's pretty functional. So there we go. The green countries are actually the countries that are party to the convention. So not the entire scope of their nesting sites, but it actually covers a large part of the Caribbean, which is a big area where they migrate. And also Brazil covers a large part of their nesting site on South American coast. So secretariat and committees. So the main role of the secretariat, aside from the management role, is distributing the annual reports that are put in by each party every year. Actually, I was looking at the website, and the parties have been a little sloppy about annual reports. 2006 was the most comprehensive. Since then, things have fallen off a bit. But I'll show you an example in just a second. The other two sort of unique things about this treaty are the consultative committee, which is kind of interesting because we just talked about the impact that experts in their individual capacity can have, and there is a ton of that going on in this the organization of this treaty. The consultative committee, each party gets to appoint one sort of extra representative to this committee, and that's done by pure appointment. And then there are three elected officials chosen from one of these other sectors, and those are chosen entirely by consensus. There's a nomination and election process. The scientific committee, again, each party gets to nominate a scientific expert, and then they have a series of elections to choose the final committee. These are both in an advisory capacity, but they do have a pretty thorough role in conducting independent research and reviewing research conducted by the parties themselves. They have the right to ask parties for information regarding the measures that they undertake. And actually, a big part of the consultative committee's role is evaluating the efficiency of those measures and making recommendations. They meet separately from the conference of the parties, so they have something to present at the time. And actually, the way it seems to work is a questionnaire fashion. What are the measures you've taken? International cooperation, other treaties. So again, I'll show you. The most recent conference of the party actually got pushed forward for I don't know what reason. This is what I wanted to focus on, actually, is the international cooperation aspect of the treaty. It is largely a regional treaty, but we did talk about the shrimp turtle case, and actually the migratory patterns of the sea turtles make it a very, very international issue. One of the main species of turtles that's very seriously endangered is the leatherback turtle. They can travel 6,000 miles in one migratory season, so that covers a lot of ocean. The treaty emphasizes in, I didn't write down the article, but one of the leader articles. If you're interested, I have the treaty with me, that each party should comply with CITES, the Caribbean Environment Program, and the Special Protected Areas Wildlife Protocol, which are other conventions and protocols that are in play in the region itself. And Article 12, in particular, actively encourages the parties to recruit other nations, even the ones that aren't directly in the Americas, to participate in protection measures. And actually, Article 20 is, to me, the most interesting, because it acknowledges sort of the weaknesses of this one regional treaty and the fact that it can't address the whole problem because of the turtles' migratory patterns, and sort of aspires to a broader national treaty with the same kinds of concrete requirements that could be imposed sort of more effectively to control and to implement the objectives of the treaty. I did some research, but I couldn't find any, you know, idea of what the progress has been on that so far. But, you know, maybe sometime in the future we'll hear something else about another sea turtle treaty. A couple other things. One thing is there's a really interesting provision in the treaty that allows for states to invite other states and NGOs, other sort of experts as participants at the conference of the parties. They can submit documents, they can be present as observers. And in case anyone's interested, this is one of the sort of non-governmental organization reports that was submitted at one of the conferences of the parties. And it talks about some of their concerns, some of which are a little more drastic than others. In this one in particular, they propose an amendment that sort of gets rid of the trade compliance provision and suggests that, you know, the main focus should be protection of sea turtles, you know, all consequences for trade be damned kind of thing. So you can see why they enter mostly in an advisory capacity or observer rather than as active parties. But it is interesting that they can be invited. So that's one, in case you want to pass it around.
Do you know what country invited?
No, I don't know. I just found it in one of the lists of the conference of the parties. And actually that website has all the conference party documents, all the proposed draft resolutions. Here's one on sea turtles and climate change. So the treaty is actually very adaptive and does take into account current issues that are going on. So you can look over this one as well. I think that's all I've got in case anyone has any questions. Okay, so specific actions that the treaty covers, for example, in the appendix, it gives a list of what some parties can undertake. So, and placing limitations on fishing seasons, one, you know, that might not interfere with turtle migratory patterns to decrease bycatch. There's also the turtle excluder device idea, and the United States actually has implemented training programs in other countries like Trinidad to teach them how to use these relatively low-expense technologies to help sort of preserve the turtle populations. Those are a couple big ones. And otherwise, other big turtle or other shrimping countries like Thailand and India, they also, I think the loggerhead turtle migrates around the Indian Ocean, and so they could implement some of these same procedures if they were aware of them. And that's where the secretariat comes in sort of absorbing all this information and then redistributing the research and your report findings. So this is the United States' third annual report, actually. It gives detailed information about who put it together. And the most interesting part, really, is... And this is actually a really detailed list of all the species and what stage they're in at the time that the report was formulated, nesting sites in different states in the country. Let's see. This goes into detail about what kinds of turtles nest where and what sort of population demographics that they're looking at, whether they've increased, decreased in the past couple years, covering pretty much all the United States territories that have any relation to the treaty. One of the comments that Professor Payne had for me was the treaty does actually acknowledge some degree of commercial exception. And the one thing that it did explicitly acknowledge was the needs of traditional communities, especially in many of these Latin American countries, where there are small sort of village communities that really do depend on turtle capture, either for traditional sort of rituals or for consumption. And so countries can make limited exceptions for intentional capture in these cases, but it requires them to really heavily document exactly what those measures are and keep reporting the progress to the rest of the nation. So it is pretty detailed in its scope. This is documenting some of the serious problems that they've had in the year: vessel strikes, incidental capture, hatchlings, egg harvesting.
Light pollution issues are interesting.
Yeah.
I remember it's like tourist facilities and the coast attracts the turtles and it draws them away because they're used to seeing light on the water.
So yeah. Lots of strange things. And also, actually, I went to Costa Rica for vacation, and they're one of the major players in this treaty, and the beach was just, it was gated off. You couldn't even get onto it. We had a special tour during the day. They won't let anyone on the beach at night because it's one of the last major turtle, Atlantic green turtle nesting sites, and they're critically endangered. So, again, incidental capture and gill nets. So this is all distributed, and the United States, through the Secretariat, can share the results of their technology surveys with other countries. Okay. Mm-hmm. No, this was just done by the countries of the American continent. So. I don't believe so. Actually, Venezuela has taken a very active role. They're the depositary country. They hosted the first conference of the parties. I don't know. That's a good question. But, you know, another thing that I mentioned was international instruments. So this is the United States in particular, other things that they're involved with. CITES is up there. And then they have a list of domestic legislation that they have in place and sort of what goals, range of application that it serves according to the treaty. So if you imagine every country, all the 12 doing this, it's a pretty comprehensive information gathering service at least.
Okay.
I'll post this along with the treaty if you want. Mm-hmm. I think that's one thing. I also think that it's a very hands-off treaty. It leaves the countries to implement their own national legislation with very few restrictions. There aren't any open sanctions in the treaty, though it encourages trade between the nations that are a party to it. It doesn't lay any strict guidelines on them. And yeah, and the other thing is actually a lot of these nations already had domestic legislation in place. Like the United States had the Endangered Species Act. CITES was in place long before this. So this was more a regional implementation of, you could almost think of it as a regional focus type CITES, which looks specifically at the American region and says, they identified this problem in trade, let's take it a little closer into conservation protection. Yeah, I think so. And they were all already working towards it. This mainly helps them by giving them specific guidelines of what kinds of things that they can do. Annex 1 to the treaty lists out particular measures that countries can implement to I guess, conserve and protect the sea turtles in their region, which might help them supplement their own national legislation if they'll put new in place.
So maybe because it's a subject matter.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, turtles are not terribly controversial, I guess. Yeah, that is, you know, the TEDs and the long lines and sort of innovation, they have been helping, actually. Bycatch has been going down, but, you know, the combination of that, it's sort of counteracted by pollution and the increase in scale of fishing. So even if it's going down, I guess, by percent, really, you don't see too much of an objective difference. Okay? And no more questions? All right, let me get out of the way.
So the treaty that I wrote about is the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, which was signed in 1996. And the environmental issue that this treaty seeks to address is that of radioactive fallout from nuclear weapon explosions. And it's not purely an environmental treaty in the sense that the desire to ban nuclear weapons explosions and testing is for many reasons, including political and social and, well, everything. but the environmental aspect of it is that radioactive fallout from weapons testing is very harmful to both humans and the environment. And testing has occurred everywhere, pretty much, under the ocean and in the sky and on Earth, since 1945, when these weapons really started being developed. And while the testing is strictly controlled with the idea that mistakes won't happen, that hasn't been the case so far. And radioactive fallout has been documented to have very serious consequences for both plants, animals, and human beings. And there have been over 2,000 weapons explosions over the last 60 years. And I'm going to show you guys before I click on it. So nothing to make you pay attention, like watching a big bomb explode. But this is a virtual simulation of the Tsar bomb, which was exploded by the Soviet Union in 1961. It's considered to be the largest and most powerful weapon ever exploded in human history. And there's an actual video, but this simulation really shows it a lot better. And I'll just show it to you and then say a little bit more about the size. Oops. So this mushroom cloud that you see rising into the air, at the time of the explosion, went over 40 miles into the air, had a radius of 25 miles, and it had 100 megatons of hydrogen bomb fission, however this technology works, and it was exploded over an island in the Arctic, right above the Arctic Circle. So at the very top of the Earth, and it was so powerful that people's windows shattered in Sweden from this, and that if it had happened on the ground, it had the magnitude of a 7.1, or the strength of a 7.1 magnitude earthquake, like around the world. All that to say, and that's the biggest one ever, but the fallout from that, with a mushroom cloud that went up 40 miles into the air, is clearly, I mean, so massive. And they did have it in a remote part of the world, but with wind currents and jet streams, it's very easy to see how nuclear particles can really spread worldwide very fast. And after this bomb was exploded, the Soviet Union decided not to continue making it or try to use it because it was so prohibitively expensive. So this treaty's point is, let's not ever explode any nuclear weapons again. And there are 168, I think, signatory states, but there are Annex I states who are members and Annex II. And the Annex II members are the ones that are really the important ones. I hate to say important, but really it's true, because the treaty will not enter into force unless the Annex II countries have all ratified it. And the Annex II countries are the ones that have nuclear weapons capabilities. And of the 44 signatories who are Annex II, only 35 have signed the treaty. So this treaty is still not entered into force. And among those that have signed but not ratified, go ahead. Yeah, that's correct. So just specifically the testing of nuclear weapons. And the United States has not ratified, nor has Iran or China and India, Pakistan. So a lot of these countries, North Korea, I don't think North Korea is even a signatory. But all that to say that the countries with the most sort of desire to maybe explode nuclear weapons have not yet ratified the treaty. And what the treaty will have members who ratify it do is, the state has to agree to not carry out any weapons test explosions, and additionally has to not allow anyone within the states who's not a state party to carry out nuclear test explosions. Those are the basic obligations of the treaty. This is what I was saying, that in the U.S., the history of this is the United States signed the treaty when it was open for signatures, but the Senate rejected it very heavily. President Obama did state in his campaign that he will support the United States ratification of the CTBT, which is the shorthand for the treaty. And like I said, other important countries that have not signed or ratified include the ones you see on the slides. And the way that this treaty works is, it sets up a verification regime consisting of an international monitoring system and an international data site based in Vienna, with 330 sites around the world that are supposed to actually monitor to make sure that states aren't exploding nuclear weapons. Because the idea, the reason there have to be these verification sites, is that probably a state is not going to say in its report annually that we exploded a nuclear weapon. So these sites are supposed to measure through seismic changes, hydro. I don't understand the technology, but they're supposed to check. And because the treaty hasn't entered into force yet, the international monitoring system isn't official yet, but it's being set up in all the sites worldwide. And in addition, what would have been the conference of the parties so far has actually been like conferences to try to facilitate the entry into force of the treaty, after which there will be conferences of the parties, along with the technical secretariat to manage the technical verification aspects, and the executive council, which is voted, the members of the executive council are voted upon every couple of years, and they come from all the different parts of the world, to be fair. And the Professor Payne asked us to pick sort of one of the themes that she mentioned to talk about, and my question to address is this really an international law treaty, or is it a region-specific treaty? And I think that the answer to that question is that historically it was a more regional and geopolitical treaty, in that it really came out of Cold War politics. It sort of is the byproduct of first there came the Partial Test Ban Treaty, which was the first foray into trying to do this, and followed by the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. And again, these weren't purely environmental treaties. They were political ones with obvious environmental impacts. But after, you know, this was open for this, the treaty was created in 1996, sort of at the very end of the Cold War, where this was more, it would work better. I don't think that this treaty would have worked, say, in 1970 completely. But once the United States sort of was firmly the world superpower, this became more palatable to the countries. And in the sense that very few countries had access to nuclear weapons at the beginning of the last 60 years, it really would, you know, the idea that stemmed, that created this was a regional one, like the Soviet bloc versus the American bloc. But as more and more countries have developed nuclear weapons, and as the technology has spread across the world, I think that this really has become an international one. The 44 countries that are in Annex II really are from all different continents, including Asia and North America and so on. And so I think that while Annex II still dominates, there's this recognition that this is a worldwide problem, and that there has to be worldwide participation, or it's pointless, because the way that countries agree to join and ratify this treaty is that if they see that other countries are willing to do it, because that's sort of the game that's played when it comes to nuclear weapons. We won't do it, you know, the whole, it's a power play. And so if one country, if India joins and ratifies the treaty, then Pakistan might do it, or vice versa, but one won't do it without any indication that the other will. And so I think that the treaty definitely has become more international, but with the caveat that it still hasn't entered into force, and so it's still in wait. So, any questions? The sort of the countries that, the more powerful countries that first had the nuclear weapons, almost frankly admit that one of the reasons they're willing to be a part of this treaty and the conference or the test ban organization is that this will make the countries who don't have it continue to not have nuclear weapons, because if you can't test them, if you can't explode them, then you can't have weapons that you can use. So there are definitely, that's part of the reason, I think, that the countries with nuclear weapons are willing to be parties to this treaty? Is that idea that this will stop other countries from having it? And whether it's fair or not, I think that's the reality of it.
Yes?
You mentioned who wouldn't sign it. Was that exhaustive, or did you include other countries?
No, they're out of the Annex II, the 44 Annex II countries, 9 of them haven't ratified. This map tells me that France has ratified. I'm sure you're right. I don't know about it. I can.
Yeah, in French Polynesia. And then I'd like to add a comment. In the Philippines, it's constitutionally written that nuclear weapons are not allowed in the country. So that is one of the reasons, one of the controversial issues raised by opposition to American bases and the visiting parties agreement is in the Philippines. So it's right, right under the Constitution.
Okay.
If the sort of overreaching goal is not just to prevent testing, but sort of a rein on nuclear usage, is there any, I don't know, aspiration to include like depleted uranium and things that aren't sort of big test explosion weapons, but are more common usages of nuclear weapons?
You mean in terms of in nuclear power plants or things
well,
like?
No, so like currently used nuclear items, I guess, in military force.
Oh, I see.
Does that make sense? Sorry.
No, it does. This the treaty specifically addresses I should say that the words in the treaty itself specifically just address the explosion of nuclear weapons, but there's this forward-looking approach that once, it all depends on the entry into force, because there's this larger organization that's supposed to come out of this, which can aspire to amend the treaty to add things, but it's sort of, you know, if you amend the treaty and it's still not entered into force. But I think, you know, when the organization has a really great website that explains the history and everything else, so I think the idea would be to contain all sorts of nuclear problems, but first it has to come into force before that's addressed, I think. Mm-hmm. There are 17 or 18 articles, and one of them specifically says that we recognize that there's, in order to prevent the environmental and health damages that come from nuclear fallout, we're implementing this treaty. So it is specified, and it's in the preamble as one of the purposes. I don't think that there are.
Beyond the scope. I think that seems beyond the scope of the assignment.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
No, but I don't think that there are. Yeah.
About the enforcement, I was wondering what if, for example, it's already in effect and somebody made a nuclear testing. I mean, what are the consequences?
Well, that is a very, I would say that's probably the chief weakness, is that what are you going to do? It says that the parties will address the situation by meeting within 6 months of the incident and talking about it. You know, it's, we're not going to declare war. And so I think that that's definitely where it, but the idea of entering into this is that you don't want to explode, because what if then your enemy, you know, that's still there, like the power balance. And so if you explode a nuclear weapon, hopefully you don't have enemies who have them too, because then you just put yourself, you made yourself open to risk. But self-destruction, right. Continued in treaty form. Okay, thank you.
So I'm going to talk about the NAIC, which is the North American Agreement on Environmental Cooperation. And the NAIC is very closely linked to the NAFTA, which is the North American Free Trade Agreement, which, as I suppose you know, is a very important agreement in the North American continent between Canada, the U.S., and Mexico, aimed at fostering trade and investment liberalization and at removing barriers between the three countries. And so the NAIC is one of the two side agreements to the NAFTA. The other one is on labor cooperation. And it was these two side agreements were negotiated as part of the pressure by unions and environmental NGOs. And President Clinton, first as a candidate and then as a president, strongly supported the negotiation of an environmental treaty as the necessary a complement to the trade agreement, which was NAFTA. So it was thanks to his support and that these two other side agreements were also negotiated, and they came all three into force in 1994. So the treaty is a very particular treaty and is kind of different to the ones the other people have analyzed, because it does not focus on a specific environmental problem, matter, or issue, but it's just a general environmental cooperation between the three countries. So cooperation, which means organization building elements, but means also promotion and promotion of education in environment, in fostering research in environmental matters. So a general treaty regarding cooperation. The treaty establishes an organization, and it builds the CEC, which is the Commission for Environmental Cooperation, which is based in Montreal, Quebec, Canada. And the CEC is comprised by three bodies, the Council, the Secretariat, and the JPEG, which is the Joint Public Advisory Committee. So as we saw before, it kind of reflects the usual structure with some particularities, because the Council is the political and governing body of the organization. So It's comprised by the political representatives of the parties, and it takes the most important decisions, and it decides usually by consensus. So it has to oversee the implementation of the treaty, develop recommendation on its further elaboration, and oversees the working of the secretariat, and deals with disputes between the parties. The Secretariat, as in all MEAs, is the bureaucratic, technical body of the organization, and provides support to the other bodies. It's headed by an executive director who is chosen on a rotation basis between the three countries, who acts totally in independent and in autonomy to the parties, and is an international, truly international organ, and does not receive any instructions, or should not receive any instructions by the by his government or any of the parties. Finally, the Joint Public Advisory Committee is a technical body, so experts who sit in their independent capacity and provides scientific and technical and other kind of information if the two other bodies need that. The three bodies are entrusted with different powers. None of these bodies have the power to issue binding decisions towards the parties. The Council may issue recommendations on every environmental issue. The Secretariat may do this, but only in its annual report. And if it wants to start other kind of reports, it has certain limitations, because it needs to be sort of authorized by the council. So it may issue a recommendation, but only in certain specific documents. And the JPEG is not entitled to issue recommendations because it only provides technical support. So the parties chose to keep a strict control on the bodies. Something that I wanted to focus a little bit about was the citizen submission procedure, because it's one of the main features characterizing the treaty. And of course, the treaty has some provisions on dispute resolution between the three states, which are kind of traditional. So it says that disputes between the states have to be resolved amicably, and if not possible, they first go to the council, and then the council may establish an arbitral tribunal, and the arbitral tribunal may then issue a report. Also, the dispute settlement provisions between the states are characterized by strong control of the parties and an effort in all the stages to reach a solution by mutual consent rather than by a confrontational in a confrontational manner. So also the arbitral body would always try to have the consent of the accused party and try to find a solution to solve the compliance problem. The citizen submission procedure is something very different, because it allows, in order to monitor compliance, it allows private citizens, NGOs, and in general individuals from either party, either state, to file a submission alleging that the party has failed to effectively enforce its environmental laws. One thing that is important is that the treaty, the parties were not able, or they did not want to establish substantive uniform environmental standards. So the treaty does not provide for uniform standards which the parties have to reach. It says that every party has the right to establish its own standards according to its development level. But what the treaty does is it gives the citizens the opportunity to raise an issue of enforcement to that particular environmental standard, so which should be enforced. The citizen submission starts with a filing by the citizen, and there is a screening by the secretariat, controlling mainly formal requirements and notably that the submission must not be aimed at promoting must be aimed at promoting enforcement rather than harassing industry. And if the secretariat thinks that the requirements are met, it may request a response from the state party. And so far, the parties have been very collaborative and cooperative, and have always responded, of course, like trying to justify their non-compliance. But there's always been a very, pretty much a cooperation. If the secretariat is not happy with the state's response, it may decide to develop a factual record. However, to do this, it needs 2/3 of the majority. So at least it means that two out of the three states have to agree on that. And again, the publication of this factual record is the progress and outcome of the submission. However, it needs again a specific authorization by the council. So it may not be so easy to come to a conclusion. And finally, I wondered, is this mechanism effective? And there has been many voices for and against that. In this like 12-13 years of working, there have been more or less 60 or something like that submissions, and they have concerned many different topics. But what some people say is it helps, because it puts a spotlight on some certain problems. Others, of course, criticize the fact that there is no real possibility to issue binding recommendations, and not even to talk that there are no possible sanctions. So so how it's a very debated debated issue and still controversial, but I think it's a very interesting one because it's a mechanism that really allows private entities who usually don't have a standing in international law to sort of bring to raise their voice in a certain forum. So I thought it was interesting. If you have any questions about that. Yeah. Yeah.
So this was the resolution of sort of patched together because basically the trade deal had been done.
Yeah.
It's interesting to see how it's played out.
They feared basically that, for example, Mexico would be like a pollution heaven. In a sense, so the most advanced groups wanted really to establish common standards. They didn't achieve that, but at least they built a sort of a structure and procedures in order to at least try to enforce the standards that are at least there for the moment, and to try to build on cooperation between the three states. So.
Maybe a slightly critical approach to
Yeah. Yeah.
I was wondering, I might not have caught it, so pardon.
Yeah, no, maybe I was not very clear.
No, you were. On the citizen comments provision,
yeah.
Is it possible, is that kind of across boundaries? So if I'm like part of an environmental group in the U.S., but I know a violation to the Mexican environmental law across the border, then I can.
Yeah, you can. Yeah. It's mixed. I mean, you don't have to accuse your own government. You can accuse any of the three, and so providing a little bit of statistics at the beginning, Mexico was the main received the main submissions, but also now it's almost the same with Canada. And some people think also because Canada has very very strong NGOs, environmental NGOs. So maybe that's also a reason why it's. There are so many cases against Canada, but mainly it's Mexico, of course.
So Canada, it's mainly Canadian NGOs.
Again, their own government. Against their own government. Yeah, that's then there are other. There have been some interesting cases. One of the first was about a cruise ship pier that was being built in Cozumel, which is this nice island. In Yucatan, maybe somewhere you went, but it took a while before the factual record developed, and so when the factual record finally came to an end, the pier had already been built. So it's also it's a part of the international law problem. So it's a. Yeah, the Mexican complaints usually stem from Mexican NGOs or groups. So yeah, there's been some movement on that. So yeah.
I think so.
I think so. Yeah. Yeah, I'm not sure though. The CEC website? I think so. Yeah, you have the three languages always,
Sorry, about the responding, you said that there was high level of responding. Was there any situation where the government didn't respond?
No, usually the government always responded. What happened in the last years is that the council started to... When the factual record, so the second stage, had to be developed, they provided the authorization, but they limited the scope under which the secretariat may, look into. So they would say, okay, you can establish a factual record, but you're not allowed to address this and this and these issues. So usually the states were responsive, so they provided an answer to the submissions. But then they try to limit, in certain cases, they've tried to limit the scope of the analysis of the secretariat in certain cases. So.
I was wondering if there was any
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, that's a good question. I don't know. Well, there is a first stage where the secretariat makes a sort of screening. So, yeah, so like, I think many requests get rejected because they don't meet all the requirements, and there are many requirements, so probably the secretariat does a certain screening, and then only a certain number of files gets to a certain stage. Okay, thank you.